listening to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Live at the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C., you're listening to The Tidbit, brought to you by Curate. I'm your host and the CEO of Curate, Kim Bryden. Do you run a small business or have dreams to start one? Each episode of The Tidbit, we discuss tidbits of knowledge around starting or running a small business with a food and beverage lens. This could be tips on starting and growing a business, entrepreneurship lessons learned, or even overall food and beverage trends that are shaping our industry and society at large. And food touches everything, right? I mean, food is what we consume. It's also job creation and economic development. It's tourism. It's science. It's health. It's relief. It's justice, history. It's current events. And today we are going to explore the intersection of food, history, culture, and art. And we spoke two episodes ago about self-care and the creative process. And one of my intentions for this year is to take time for myself each month to do something that jogs a different part of my creative brain. And if you had asked Kim of 10-year-old Kim, if you will, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would have said an actress. Actually, my sisters and I, we painted a mural about our dreams in my parents' garage, and it's still there. There's still this self-painted portrait behind my family minivan of Kim's acting dreams. I went to Broadway plays as a young girl. I acted in local theater troupes in middle school and throughout high school. And yes, in college, I was even in the Vagina Monologues. And unfortunately, this has been a part of me that I haven't explored in quite some time, and I really miss it. But fortunately, though, I decided to do something about it, and I had the pleasure of attending a show at Everyman Theater in Baltimore to sort of re-engage and spark this part of my creative brain. And the show, it's called Aubergine, and it's a performance about the complexities and emotions around food, family, and culture, and so it's clearly right up my alley. And I am so happy that we are joined in studio today with the lead actor of Aubergine, Tony Nam. And before we dive into conversation, we're going to play a short clip of the play before welcoming Tony. So here it goes. Take a listen.
An eggplant? Well, yes, eggplant. But aubergine sounds so much more beautiful. Eggplant, that makes it sound like an awkward, milky white, sickly thing. But aubergine, that starts to approach the beauty of the thing itself.
Where did you get this?
I grew it.
It's beautiful.
I know. I have a small plot in a community garden next to a church. It's right in the middle of the city. But you don't feel like you're in the city at all. Right now, it is aubergine season. They hate to be cold, like me. They need warmth and space. Pick them too soon or too late, and they will be bitter. Knowing the right time, that is part of the art.
You grew up with these?
No. Yes, but not like this. This is an American eggplant. You will not see anything like that where I am from. There they are, like this. And so many colors, red, green, white. That is how they all used to be, before they lost their wildness.
Why don't you grow those?
Impossible. They would die here. No, these are better. They are hardy, they are strong, they are large.
But how do they taste?
Call them aubergines. Then they taste better.
Thank you.
Awesome. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So to get right into it, Washington City Paper actually described aubergine as a, quote, a richly layered play about food, memory, and immigrant families. So tell us a bit more about this play, and specifically, why did this script speak to you and inspire you?
Well, the play itself, it centers around the character I play, Ray, who is a classically trained chef. He's Korean-American, and at the start of the play, he's sort of at this crisis point where his father is very ill and in hospice care, and so he takes a leave of absence to take care of his father. It's sort of a time in his life where he's realizing he's going to be losing this person that has been such a huge part of his life, but that he's had a difficult relationship with, and sort of trying to find a way to reconnect, to have this last chance to sort of mend some bridges, but he's not quite capable, or he doesn't quite know how to do that. And the way that food plays in, the scene that was just played is actually one of my favorites in the play, and is a good example of how food has become this way that the characters in this play can communicate with each other when words fail them.
Food
as a communication tool, yeah. And food, the way that it immediately brings up memories, it immediately connects you to your family and the culture that you come from, even if it's a culture that you feel a bit alienated from or that you try to distance yourself from, it still draws you back in a way that at one time, like, hard to describe, but also immediate.
Mm-hmm. That was something very profound about the play for me, was one, that it was bilingual, and two, right, a lot of the conversation that was brought up around the dissonance between generations and how does one assimilate or not assimilate to American culture while also keeping true to the identity of their parents, and how food really, like we were saying, is that communication or bridge, right, between these worlds.
Right, right. It's really a big reason why I connected so immediately with this play. I mean, the first time I read it, I got very emotional and I teared up, just because there's so much in what Julia Cho, the playwright, has written here that just feels so intimate and so home to me. Like, it really does feel like this character, his experience, like I understood it just innately, which was an amazing experience. I've never had that kind of immediate connection to a play before. As soon as I read it, I knew, like, yeah, I have to do this. This is, an amazing opportunity.
Shout out to female playwrights.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And Julia is just such a beautiful writer. And she really has just captured something, at one time very, that's unique about a Korean American experience and about growing up in a Korean American family, but at the same time, so universal. I mean, people who have come to see the show from lots of different backgrounds and lots of different ages, they just find something very familiar with it, and they just connect with the themes and the story in a very personal way. And it's been amazing to see and witness. And getting back to this idea of the sort of, dissonance between cultures, one way that this story was very personal to me was I also had a bit of a strained relationship with my father, and some of that did have to do with growing up in an immigrant family where, at a younger age I didn't quite appreciate as much, and I almost wanted to sort of drive away from it in a lot of ways. I didn't really keep up with the language. Like, I still understand some Korean, but I don't speak it very fluently. Growing up, I didn't really appreciate the food so much. I wanted to eat like pizzas and hamburgers like everyone else, mm-hmm, all my other friends. Now that I'm older and I'm sort of appreciating the culture that I grew up in, and the things that my parents wanted to expose me to and continue my connection to. I do find myself, sort of craving Korean food more.
Yeah. And do you have any food memories?
I have a lot of food memories, actually. I mean, there's one that I shared with every man. My mom made these, I guess they're pot stickers or dumplings called mandu, that she would make for almost every special occasion, like Christmas, Thanksgiving, birthdays.
Yeah.
And she would... It's sort of one of those things where you can't just make a dozen of them. Like, you have to make hundreds of them at a time. And she would spend like nearly an entire afternoon, making these. And it would almost be this family ritual. Like, she would make the sort of ingredients and prepare everything, and then you actually have to hand make these pot stickers. And so it would be an afternoon of her and my sister sitting around the table, just making these pot stickers and talking. And I would try to make some, but I wasn't very good.
What a great activity to also put your phone away, right?
Yeah, right.
What are these bonding experiences over food that keep you engaged and present? I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. And now, I actually had to reach out to my sister to get the recipe for these pot stickers, because my mom hasn't really made them in a long time, and I never really learned how to make them myself. But now I have the recipe, and I plan to,
amazing,
make it with my kids.
Oh, wow. What a good family night.
That would be a good family night.
My family is Hungarian Italian, and our version was making gnocchi, like very long rolls of potato dough and then cutting up, forking each one. Something tactile about making something with your hands and then also having conversation over that production of food. You put your heart and soul into it, and then it obviously tastes much better.
Right. And it's sort of lovely to think that it's something that I can do with my kids, that I have a connection to my mom, and her connection to her extended family as well. So it's sort of like,
I heard that you and the cast have been having some family meals. What has that been like?
That's been pretty wonderful, actually. I mean, the cast, we've all gotten very close. I mean, we started this project back in January, and have been seeing each other almost every day, and have been having a lot of these meals together. Fortunately, because a lot of members of the cast are really into food too, so we made a point to go find a Korean restaurant while we were in Olney, and had a couple meals there. And and Song Kim, who actually he plays the uncle in the play, he's an actual trained sushi chef.
He worked
as a sushi chef for a number of years, so he actually treated us to this enormous, incredible platter of sushi that he just whipped up some afternoon. He got the ingredients and just like made us this platter and brought it into rehearsal one day. And now we're still like, we went over to his apartment a couple weeks ago in between shows to make those pot stickers. And
oh, wonderful.
He made a kimchi jjigae, which is like a very traditional Korean stew. We just enjoy cooking for each other and cooking with each other and sharing meals together. I mean, it seems a very appropriate activity.
Absolutely. Well, before we head to break, I want you to tell our listeners, how can people find out more about Aubergine and Everyman Theater? I mean, what do you think of this venue?
Oh, the venue is fantastic. I mean, it's such a... It isn't that old. I think Everyman has been in this space for about 5 years. They've been in the Baltimore area for longer than that, but they've moved into this new space in downtown Baltimore, and it's just beautiful. And the play works so well in the space because it's so intimate, the first row of audience members are right there at your feet when you're standing on the front of the stage, and it just makes for such a lovely environment to tell this story. And people should definitely check it out. We're actually performing for two more weeks through April 15th.
Awesome.
And people can check out more information about the performances at everymantheater.org. Mm-hmm. And check out the rest of the season. I think they have one more show for this season, but they just do beautiful, beautiful work.
Amazing. Yeah, and we'll link to all of this in our show notes, curate.co/blog, curete.co. Thank you so much for joining us, Tony.
Thank you.
And after the break, we are going to sit down to continue this conversation on the intersectionality of food, history, culture, and art with Steph Su, lead organizer of the Chinatown Collective, a coming together of Baltimore's Pan-Asian community across ethnicity, across industry, and across generations. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Tidbit. Hi, Steph. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
So on the first half of this show, we spoke with Tony, of course, the lead actor of Aubergine. And I want to sort of continue this conversation by talking about your role. And you've been this integral part of spearheading the growth of the Chinatown Collective in Baltimore. And mm-hmm. your mission, let me get this right, to amplify the voices and experiences of the Baltimore-based Asian American Pacific Islander artists, entrepreneurs, and creatives. So tell us more about this. I mean, Baltimore has a strong history of API immigration in Baltimore,
mm-hmm,
and how is it sort of leading to activism of this younger generation?
Mm-hmm. Well, what's actually really interesting is that there's actually first and foremost, when you say Baltimore's Chinatown, most people say, you know, where?
What?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When did this happen? And one of the big pieces of like this conversation is that there isn't a lot around the historical preservation of, you know, this information about, you know, the original kind of AAPI immigrants to Baltimore City, whether Chinese or Korean, as was largely the case. But the earliest traces, I mean, you know, very, very brief history, the earliest cases of Chinese residents were actually in the late 1700s with Captain O'Donnell. One popular Baltimore neighborhood by the water, Canton, actually was named for Canton, China, because it reminded Captain O'Donnell of that port city when he was traveling.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's a lot more history there that I'm sure is, you know, exists in somewhere, but we haven't quite uncovered yet. But some other early kind of pieces that we found through the Enoch Pratt Library and the Maryland Historical Society actually indicate that there were early Chinese business owners as early as the 1920s. And so there's actually one journal that has been kept that actually has, it's kind of like a de facto dictionary of sorts where, you know, this gentleman, a laundromat owner, wrote words in English and then translated them to Chinese. And so you kind of get to see a snapshot, you know, in the day in the life of a Chinese immigrant, you know, and it starts out with words like hospitality and resources and then turns into affidavit and, you know, just very, very
wow.
different. But, you know, kind of in parallel paths, you see now if you go to Station North area, right around Penn Station, you'll actually see a huge mural on the wall right outside of the Impact Hub. And that actually is the father of Jaewon Kim, who actually was one of the first business owners to that area. So they actually started a business called Seoul Rice Cake, which is still there, you know, kind of manufacturing the really traditional, you know, rice cakes that, you know, you could use either at home or, you know, eat in the restaurant and things like that. But, you know, all of these things kind of exist. And I think really to kind of sum it all up, the name of the mural is actually really poignant. The name of that mural is actually Remembering the Future. And so, you know, a lot of the, a lot of like the history, even though a lot of it's largely unknown, activism really has kind of stemmed from a younger generation who have grown up in Baltimore, you know, people who understand the nuances of not being black or white in a black and white city. And, you know, if anything, the discovery of these historical pieces really serves only to expand the cultural narrative of Baltimore's history into one that kind of exists in a larger context. And so, You know, one of the, I think, kind of ongoing conversations that we as second and third generation have, you know, is this idea of being a perpetual foreigner, the idea that, you know, no matter how long we've been here, whether we grew up here, you know, we might at any given point in a day get, you know, at worst a statement saying something like, you know, go back to where you came from and that kind of thing. And so really kind of these stories, right, of, you know, Jaewon Kim, his father, you know, and these stories of these Chinese early Chinese immigrants only serves to kind of richen the idea that, you know, we have been here. And, you know, it's not that we haven't been here before, but now that we have the cultural and lingual fluency, you know, how do we kind of keep that conversation going?
Definitely. And your specific focus around the creative community, I think, has been, and I love the fact that you brought up this mural. Absolutely beautiful. Not just business owners, but also this profound representation across the creative community, again, whether it's arts or food or music, and you're really striving to bring that out.
Yeah, and it's amazing right now in Baltimore. There's like a really great, it's just a really great time for it. You know, there are a lot of, I think we joke that, you know, a lot of us as second generations are, you know, being, there's a hashtag out there, it's bad Asians, you know, Asians who don't go into being a doctor or lawyer and instead, you know, choose to pursue kind of these creative industries. And there's a lot of space for that in Baltimore right now, which I think is speaks a lot to Baltimore City.
Absolutely. So you had mentioned what Chinatown is in Baltimore right now. So sort of paint that picture, because I think our listener is used to or maybe familiar with Chinatown in D.C. or New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles. But what about Baltimore? Like, what is that physical space currently?
Yeah, so it's really only two blocks. And, you know, more than anything, I'd say Chinatown is a feeling and is a collection of relationships more than it is a geographical space. And so, I mean, for me personally, right, my discovery of the area was normally if I need Asian groceries, I'll go out to H Mart or Lotte, you know, out in the county. And I actually had heard that there was a Chinese grocery down on Park Avenue, so I figured I'd, you know, why not stumble down there. And as I walked out, you know, I noticed a lot of these buildings that had kind of these pagoda-like facades and, you know, a lot of old Chinese kind of writing and things like that. And specifically, I saw this one restaurant across the street that is called the China Doll Restaurant, which was actually funny because the week before somebody had yelled, hey, China Doll, out of a car window. And so it's this kind of like very circular, like all coming together moment of like, oh my God, like, you know, where am I? Like, you know, Baltimore City, like, this is a place where I can exist. And, like, this is a place where we have existed. And that was kind of like the first indication. And, you know, like, there are like certain kind of design elements, right? Like I mentioned, the kind of pagoda facades that do indicate that this did used to historically be a Chinatown. But really, more than anything, you know, right now, Chinatown, we call ourselves the Chinatown Collective, right? Because the collective expands beyond just the Chinese community. There's, you know, a wealth of many, many different Asian ethnicities in Baltimore City right now. And part of, you know, what we're doing is to highlight and showcase, you know, that we are not a monolith, that there are so many different nuances to all of the different cultures that are kind of encapsulated there.
So I was told to ask you, Steph, who is Kitty Chin? Who is Kitty?
She's a wonderful, wonderful woman. She is now somewhere approximately around 90 years old, but you wouldn't be able to tell. She and her husband, Calvin, were very active in the early Chinese community, and they, you know, ran and were an integral part of the Chin Association. And we're both also very active in the city. And so when Chinese residents, early Chinese residents, started to move out to the county, they actually started a Baltimore Asian Trade Council to kind of promote Asian and Asian American businesses in the city. And that in and of itself was pan-ethnic. So, you know, kind of one of the early forth thinkers of the Asian Asian American community, you know, really trying to bring everyone together. And their whole vision and idea for that space and bringing the space back was not that it would be a Chinatown, but that it would be like an Asia town, right? So one that included the growing immigrant communities of, you know, the Korean community, the Filipino community, the Vietnamese community. And that's the kind of idea that they had. And that's kind of the spirit with which we're moving forward, you know. And Kitty herself actually has amazing records of, you know, just historical photographs and articles from, you know, the time when you know, they were really in their heyday. And one of the articles actually is the most poignant, I think, which has, like, really moved us forward, which talks about, you know, how some of the traditions are kept in the second generation, but some are not. And, you know, kind of like this whole idea. And that really was kind of what spurred this thought, right? So that article was written 60 years ago. And so wow. The same thought was like, well, if this could have been literally written yesterday, then in another 60 years, you know, if we don't kind of take action to preserve these pieces, then, you know, what's next?
This is a beautiful segue, Steph. So we are sitting down with Steph Su, the lead organizer of the Chinatown Collective. And we just discussed the historical context of the Asian American Pacific Islander community in Baltimore. And we're going to take a quick break and then talk about how we can take action and move forward next.
Music on this show is produced by a local artist named Franklin. We'll be right back on The Tidbit.
We're back on The Tidbit. We're sitting down with Steph Su, the lead organizer of the Chinatown Collective, which is a coming together of Baltimore's pan-Asian community across ethnicity, across industry, and across generations. You all, you're artists. You are chefs, you are filmmakers, you're experimenters, you're advocates for all people of color, and even more so, you're residents of Baltimore City who believe that investment begins with action. So we talked about earlier the historical context of the AAPI community. So what does the Chinatown Collective taking action look like?
So I think, you know, before we start with action, we all sat down in a room and talked about or ask the question, what is cultural exchange? And what does cultural exchange look like in Baltimore City? And so, you know, before we kind of talk about like these like larger initiatives that we're focusing on, one of the main takeaways is that, you know, a lot of cultural exchange happens in relationships and in the kind of daily interactions and friendships that we naturally forge. And so I'll just provide a couple of really amazing examples that currently exist in Baltimore of people of AAPI descent creating excellence in their own circles and communities. So one really great example is a steam bun shop called Ekibun. Mm-hmm. They do fried chicken and steam buns, which sounds peculiar, but amazing. They are super, super, super good. And the two owners, one is Taiwanese and one is Ethiopian. And both of them are friends from college and you know, it's just kind of like a natural coming together of both of their, you know, both of their styles.
And they have an really amazing cool social media presence.
They do. You should definitely follow them.
Again, linking to all of this in our Curate blog.
Yeah. And then another really cool example is an organization called the Baltimore Dance Cruise Project. So the Baltimore Dance Cruise Project is founded by two Teach for America, TFA alum, who both are Filipino. And you know, they are using dance now as a medium for connecting with their students and as a way to, you know, kind of cultivate mentorship throughout Baltimore City. And so Cynthia's story, and she can tell a much better version of it than I can, but essentially, right, finding a way to connect with their students, you know, for the first time doing a hip-hop dance routine and having the students, you know, just kind of stare, you know, in amazement and realize that there are ways to connect with someone with whom you never thought you could through dance. And so through the Baltimore Dance Cruise Project, they've actually, the students have actually choreographed a recent piece kind of in response to or in coordination with the Baltimore ceasefire movement. And it's actually become a really poignant and moving piece that the students themselves are able to produce and create through the help of the BDCP.
And just mm-hmm. for our listeners to know more, the Baltimore ceasefire is typically a week-long mm-hmm. initiative of the Baltimore community coming together to make sure that there are no killings mm-hmm. That week. Mm-hmm. And so that's really wonderful. This art as activism yeah, was absolutely. A part of it as well.
Yeah. And then the last example I'll have, bringing it all back to food, of course, is of chef and artist Dylan Ubaldo and Chef David Thomas of Ida B's Table. So Dylan actually started a pop-up called Kalasag, and they do Filipino food, traditional style. But they recently did a dinner where Dylan and Chef David kind of collaborated and talked about the history of, you know, both, you know, Filipino food and, you know, soul food, and kind of how, like, there are a lot of similarities, right? And in the choices of, for example, meat cuts that they use, right? That a lot of them are, you know, what were thrown away, you know, in by, like, you know, people who were in, like, classes, that had higher social standing, right? And then, and kind of like how those cultures have now taken them and really embodied them into something that really means a lot more, and that has like, you know, a much richer history, and that there are so many parallels and intersections there. And so that was something that was really cool to see. And so I think, you know, above all, really like the biggest action that we have taken right now is connecting with each other and, you know, really creating a platform for all of us to, you know, come together and say, this is what we're doing in our circles and our communities. What are you doing in yours? And how can we showcase all of that?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually had Marissa Dobson from Baltimore on episode 2 of The Tidbit, and she alluded to this amazing collaboration of that intersection of Filipino and soul food. And so I'm so pleased that it's come to fruition and that Baltimore's embraced that collaboration so beautifully. And one of the other ways that you are taking action in the coming months is with the Charm City Night Market. So I personally am very excited about this, and I'm sure our listeners are now as well. But it's going to be held during the first weekend of the Asian American. Tell us more. Tell us more about Charm City Night Market.
So Charm City Night Market is going to be our kind of physical manifestation of all of these conversations. So we're throwing a huge block party, essentially. On September 22nd, which happens to coincide with the kind of mid-autumn lunar festival. So September 22nd from 5 to 11 p.m., we'll be bringing together about 60 different vendors, both food and art, as well as about 10 different local performances and a soju sake and beer garden, all on the 200 block of Park Avenue. So two reasons why that space in particular is super important for us. So we have Park Avenue, which was historically the Chinatown, and so we're just a couple blocks down from there. And then we are also right on the intersection of Lexington Street, which actually leads up to Lexington Market, which is one of Baltimore's most historic public markets. And so kind of bringing together these two worlds of something that is so inherently Baltimore and something that's so inherently Asian American, and really taking that opportunity to celebrate each other.
Wow. The intersection of food, history, culture, and art. Exactly. So how can people stay involved and find out more as the Chinatown Collective grows and expands and puts out more amazing events like this one?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find us both on Facebook and on Instagram. For the Chinatown Collective, it's just at the Chinatown Collective. And for the night market, it's at Charm City Night Market.
Amazing. Thank you both for being here in studio today. And until next time, everyone, remember to scale thoughtfully and source locally.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.